Let's go back to the story we were involved in when we ran out of time last session. And that means we should be in Matthew chapter 16, starting at verse number 5. And the parallel is in Mark chapter 8, verse 14. And you know that the situation is that they're at Magdala on the west coast of the Sea of Galilee. They're under the shadow of Mount Arbel. It's a major fishing port, fish processing port, where Jesus has ministered apparently in the past. This is where Mary Magdalene came from. And so Jesus has this confrontation with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They're demanding that he demonstrate his identity and his authority by giving them some sort of supernatural sign of their demand. But Jesus' response is that they are part of an adulterous generation, a wicked and adulterous generation that's looking for signs and wonders, and the only thing they're going to get that should make a difference to them is the sign of Jonah, which is the sign of resurrection. Jesus being dead, coming back to life again on the third day thereafter. So Jesus then leaves that frustrating environment at Magdala and gets back into the boat, heading for the northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee. Matthew 16:5 takes up the story. When the disciples reached the other side, or as they were reaching the other side, they had forgotten to bring any bread. And Jesus said to them, "Watch and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." And they began discussing it among themselves, saying, "We brought no bread." So these apostles are all focused on the physical. They're all caught up in the here and now moment that Jesus apparently is looking for some leavened bread, or maybe he's looking for some unleavened bread, and all they have is like one little loaf of bread that might have leaven in it. And so it's all their fault, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they start blaming each other. Why didn't you bring appropriate bread for him to eat, and all that? And Jesus figures out that that's what his teaching moment has brought up in the hearts of these apostles, and starts to chide them, starts to get after them. And the reason that he chides them is because we're only about 6 months away from them having to take up the mantle of teaching. Because 6 to 7 months from the moment of this story, Jesus will have been crucified, resurrected, ascended on high, and the apostles are going to be the leaders of his church. And they aren't ready for that yet, because they're still not quite clicking with key components of his teaching. So Jesus gets after them in this fashion. Matthew 16:8. Jesus, aware of this, aware of them getting off on this tangent of physicality, said, "Oh, you of little faith, why are you discussing among yourselves the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive? Do you not remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets you gathered?" In the Mark account, which is apparently Peter's recollections, Jesus actually asks them, you know, "How much did you have left over on the 5,000? 12 baskets. How much did you have left over in the feeding of the 4,000? 7 baskets. And so in each case, they ended up with a ton more than what they started with. So bread is not a problem for Jesus. The provision of physical food is not an issue for him. So Jesus is basically saying, "Guys, reprocess, think again. Do you honestly think that I'd be getting after you because you didn't bring food along in the boat? Don't you think I could remedy that pretty easily for just the few of us?" So, verse 11 of Matthew 16. How is it that you fail to understand that I'm not speaking about physical bread? And then he does the thing that we teachers, we parents often do after we kind of get after our students or our kids. And that is, let's redo the problem. Let's redo the exercise. Let's try it again and see if this time you think through it the way you need to. So he says to them again, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And so now they get the chance to redo, and they get it right. Verse 12, then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread. This isn't about bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. That the Pharisees and the Sadducees are off kilter. The Pharisees are off kilter because they are making it all about ritual, not relationship. The Sadducees are off kilter because they have denied the power of God's word and the power of God at all, because they don't believe in the supernatural. So neither one of these leaders of Jewish society are going to help people reach a relationship with God. The apostles cannot go down the Pharisee or Sadducee path and expect to accomplish the work of God. They have to follow Jesus' leading on this. So, lesson learned, hopefully. And then they arrive at their destination, which is the northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee. Mark chapter 8, verse 22 tells us about this. Then they came to Bethsaida. Now, it's problematic for a lot of people in their studies that they don't understand there are two Bethsaidas at this time in close proximity to one another. They're in two different countries, though. There is Bethsaida, Galilee, which is about a mile and a half west of Capernaum. But then there's this Bethsaida, Bethsaida Julius, or Bethsaida Julia, which is just a few miles east of Capernaum, along the Roman road, and across the Jordan River into another country called Golanitis, or what we call today the Golan. This city on the northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee is where near where Jesus did the feeding of the 5,000. It's also along the Roman road system going east and west, and also the road system heading north. And so Jesus is actually getting off the boat here because his next destination is to the north of the Sea of Galilee, about one day's walk. And that's Caesarea of Philip, or Caesarea Philippi. So they came to Bethsaida. They got out of the boat, obviously. And some people brought to him a blind man and begged him to touch him. So as has always been the case, the moment Jesus is recognized anywhere around the Sea of Galilee, people want him to fix physical problems. So they give him this blind man and expect him to fix the blindness. But Jesus is not planning on sticking around to do ministry here at Bethsaida Julia. He is heading north to a more remote region. So he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village, or out of this town, toward the north. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" Now, I have a different approach to this miracle than some people do. I've actually heard some people talk about this being a two-stage miracle, that Jesus healed the man partially and then healed him completely in the second stage. I disagree. I actually think that what Jesus does here is evaluate his problem, and then he fixes the problem. So this is how I see him doing it. The man's eyes are what's afflicted here, got the problem. And one of the things that often happens when you have eye infections and things of that nature, a problem with your eyes, is your eyes swell up and crust over, and they're not open at all. When I was an elementary student, I spent, I don't know how many days, fighting a really nasty eye infection in both eyes. And my eyes were completely crusted over and shut. And so several times each day, my parents or my caregiver, my babysitter, would have to take a little, not a cloth, but some cotton wool and some boric acid water, and wipe away all the crustiness that was sealing my eyes shut and open it up and put drops in. I think that this man is in that sort of shape, where his eyes are crusted over and not opened. So Jesus does that mom or dad thing. All of us have either had it done to us or probably done it ourselves. And that is, use the little spit source as moisture. And, you know, you can take away dirt with it, but you can also soften up a place such as crusted up eyes in order for the eyes to be open. So I think that's exactly what Jesus did, is he simply used some of his own spit to get this guy's eyes open enough that he could then evaluate the situation. Verse 23, the second part. So he spit on his eyes as he laid his hands on him, and he asked him, "Do you see anything? So tell me what you can see." Verse 24, he looked up and he said, "I see men, but they look like trees walking." So his vision is exceptionally blurry, because people just look like this blurry figure in the distance. This man's sight apparently did exist previous to this, because he knows what people are and what they should look like, and he has a sense of what trees look like, even if they're blurry in the distance. So that's what he tells him. And then Jesus does the miracle. Verse 25, Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and then he opened his eyes, and his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. So I don't believe it was a two-stage miracle. I believe it was a miracle following an evaluation period. Verse 26, though. He then sent him to his home, saying, "Do not even enter the village." So don't go back into Bethsaida Julia. Go home. And the reason he tells him that is because he does not want to be grabbed a hold of by a great big crowd again, demanding him to do all these miracles, because Jesus has a limited amount of time to spend with his apostles, and he needs to really focus on their training for what happens at Jerusalem in about 6 to 7 months from now. Because when we're looking at this story, it seems as if we're looking at probably the sixth month of the Jewish year, because the next event that's coming up that can be dated is the Feast of Tabernacles that Jesus goes to in this year, the year 32. And that happens in the seventh month of the year, and it follows hot on the heels to these events that we're about to read. Mark chapter 8, verse 27 says, Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And Matthew tells us the same thing. It says in Matthew 16:13, Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi. Now, Caesarea is an interesting town. It is actually more of a Gentile focal point inside the kingdom or the tetrarchy of a Herodian descendant. Philip, the son of Herod the Great, is the one that is the tetrarch of this area. Caesarea has been a worship site for Gentile people going way back in history. It's one of the headwaters of the Jordan River. The Jordan River back in this time period actually bubbled up out of a cave, out of a grotto at the base of a cliff, which is it's at the foot of the tallest mountain in this region of the world. That'd be Mount Hermon. The Greeks, when they came through the area in the time of Alexander the Great and after, they had a big thing about water sources coming out of caves in wilderness areas, treed areas. So they thought of this as being one of the places where the god of the wilderness, Pan, would hang out. Therefore, he should be acknowledged with worship at this site. So there was a Gentile pagan worship area that grew up around this grotto out of which one of the heads of the Jordan River came. Eventually, this came into the control of the Herodian family, Herod the Great, and he started building a community in this area, mostly Gentile. Then his son named the community that became much more official in his time, Caesarea, after the emperor. Then it had the further name Philippi because it was Herod's Caesarea. It was Philip's Caesarea, not the one down on the coast or some of the others that were located around the Middle East. So there is a Jewish neighborhood in the city of Caesarea Philippi, but the major part of it is Gentile. The major part of it is pagan. The cliff area that we're talking about is pagan. And so there is no way in the world that Jesus and his disciples would have gone to this paganized area. Now, the reason I stress this is because I think too many people imagine Jesus standing at the base of the cliff, which is one big massive rock, and whenever he says the things that he says back to Peter. And I just can't picture it happening that way because when you go there today and been there several times and, you know, in October of next year, if you'd like to go, we're going to go again and you can stand in this area, but understand that it was a place where there were all these pagan temples. So Jesus wouldn't have been standing where we stand. But Jesus would have been able to see this cliff face from far away because it was prominent in the region of Caesarea Philippi. So in our text, Jesus is in the vicinity of Caesarea Philippi. Perhaps he can even see it in the distance. And then he begins to query his apostles as to the pulse of those that they're having interaction with in the last few months or the last year or so of their they're traveling with Jesus and doing their two-by-two thing. So with that in mind, let's go to the Matthew 16 account, because that's the one I think that's the more famous one and the one that I believe has the wording that I really want us to focus on. But keep in mind that we have the parallel in Mark chapter 8, and Luke actually jumps back into our parallels here in Luke chapter 9, starting at verse 18, which Luke actually says, "Now it happened that he was praying alone, and his disciples were with him." So what we're about to read in Matthew 16, 13 and following happens near Caesarea Philippi, perhaps even in line of sight of the cliff face that is so famous, and Jesus has been praying about things to his Father. And then he turns to his apostles and starts to talk with them. Matthew 16, 13. "Now when Jesus came into the district or the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples," his apostles specifically, "who do people say that the Son of Man is?" Now, Son of Man is a messianic title from the book of Daniel. Jesus uses it about himself. The apostles are used to that understanding. So they know that he's asking, "Who do people say that I, Jesus, am?" Their response, they said, "Some say that you're John the Immerser." Remember, John had been executed about 6 or 7 months ago now. And so some people believe that the stories of Jesus are John up and about again. "Others say that you're Elijah," or Elijah, which the Jewish understanding of the book of Malachi was that the Elijah who disappeared in the fiery whirlwind, in the flaming chariot, was going to come back again to introduce the Messiah and establish the new heavens, new earth, the eternal kingdom, all of that. So others are saying that Jesus might be the Elijah figure. And others that you might be Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And the understanding seems to be as if some of the prophets of old might be resurrected early to assist in the Messiah's establishment of the kingdom. And so Jeremiah, you know, might be one of the big names that would come back early in order to help establish the kingdom. So that's all the rumors that have been going around that these apostles have heard of. But then Jesus asked the very pointed question. And it's actually the question that we have to get people to answer. And that is, it doesn't really matter what everybody else is saying. It's, what do you say? So he said to them, "Who do you say that I am?" And then Shimon Petros, Simon Peter, replied, "You are the Christos," or the Mashiach, depending on whether he was speaking Greek or Aramaic at the point, "the Son of the living God." So this is what we refer to as the great confession of Peter. Now, the other apostles are saying the exact same thing. They're agreeing with that. "We believe that you are the Messiah, the one that we were told to wait for." Now, Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Shimon Bar-Yona, Simon the son of Jonah." That's the Aramaic formal name for Simon. "For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." So you're blessed because you're getting this stuff straight from God. And then he says this, and it's very important to pay attention to the language use here. "I tell you, You are Petros. Now, in Aramaic, his name is Kephe, which means rock. But Jesus seems to be using the Greek language here. You are Petros. Now, in the Greek language, Petros is used to refer to an individualized chunk of rock. It could be a small pebble, it could be a small boulder, or a large boulder. But it is an individualized piece of stone. I tell you, you are Petros. You are a single stone. But on this Petra, which is the feminine form, and the feminine form stands for the massive bedrock, like that cliff face, which is why it's great to tell this story when you're standing right there in front of the cliff face at Caesarea Philippi. On this bedrock, I'm going to build my church, my assembly, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Now, I think it is a misunderstanding to try to promote this idea that the pagans believed that the little grotto here at Caesarea Philippi was one of the entrances into the underworld, into Hades, and so that Jesus was trading on that. I don't believe that at all. I believe instead he is simply using this idea of the gates of death itself are not going to prevail against it. That is, Jesus being the Messiah, and us understanding that, even his death is not going to win out. Even death itself cannot win against his identity as the Messiah, because these guys are going to watch Jesus die. They are going to be frustrated and shocked that the Messiah dies, but that will not end his story. And these guys need to understand that now.